You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the coronavirus pandemic and nationwide protests against police brutality are just two of the events this year that are putting our civil institutions to the test. We talked to a guest who says our government is failing that test and our social fabric is suffering as a result. Now, President Trump signed an executive order yesterday outlining the administration's response to nationwide protests over racism and policing. The order encourages police departments to undergo new training on use of force and to use outside experts in areas like mental health to serve as co-responders. The order got pushback from criminal justice advocates who say it does little to address things like systemic racism in law enforcement. Cecilia Klingel is an associate professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School and a faculty associate at the school's Frank J. Remington Center and the La Follette School of Public Affairs. Cecilia, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
What stands out to you in this White House executive order? Do you see it as effective? Not much. Where does this fall?
I think that the executive order can't do all the things that people want it to do in terms of reforming policing, because in the United States, policing is primarily a local matter. The 18,000 law enforcement agencies in this country operate primarily at the local and state levels, not at the federal level, which limits in many ways what the federal government can do to improve our confidence in policing.
Yeah, some of what we see from the president and some of the proposals in Congress either offer incentives and grants if police, local police departments do things, or threaten to limit federal funding if they don't do things. Is that really the leverage that the federal government has, the purse strings?
Indeed, it's the power of the purse that is the primary mechanism by which the federal government is able to incentivize or punish police for engaging in certain kinds of public policy. The federal government can also engage in litigation, which is continues to be done and has been done more robustly in the past against police agencies that are seen as repeatedly violating civil rights. But the main power are the billions of dollars that the Department of Justice annually awards to police agencies in the form of grants.
Let's get into that power of lawsuits. We had seen in the past this idea of consent decrees used in the Obama administration in particular, dialed back under the Trump administration. Can you talk about these consent decrees and what they do?
Sure. So consent decrees are really negotiated agreements between two parties in a lawsuit that have been given sort of a stamp of approval by a court. They are usually the way that large-scale litigation against government institutions, schools, prisons, police agencies are resolved, where the parties come together and often without conceding error, sometimes with a concession, will agree to engage in certain kinds of reform-oriented actions, and the failure to engage in those actions can be enforced by a court's order.
Can you talk about the trajectory of those from the Obama era to the Trump era?
A little bit to that, although it falls a little bit outside my focus of specialized research. But certainly in the Obama era, there was a lot of attention to the power of the Department of Justice to bring lawsuits in communities where police had a history of engaging in excessive force. In order to give oftentimes agencies that themselves were interested in reform some political cover to agree to make large-scale changes that sometimes were quite costly. There has been some retrenchment from that kind of active litigation in the Trump administration, and obviously that generates a lot of political controversy. Whether litigation is one of the key ways of reforming police is something people disagree on quite vehemently.
Cecilia Klingel is with us, associate professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School, looking at efforts at police reform, an executive order from the president, efforts in Congress as well. Cecilia, from various kind of police reforms and community reforms that you've looked at, do we know what's effective in helping prevent incidents like the George Floyd killing that sparked all of this protest?
I think that we know a lot, And the answer is that there is no one answer. Changes can begin with the recruitment and the training and then continue to the supervision of officers. We know that policies make a big difference. We know that resources make a difference. But I think that one of the big questions we really have to answer at this time is whether what we want is more police who are better trained, who know about mental health, who understand substance use disorders, all of the things that the executive order is promoting here, or whether what we want is less policing. We want to take some of the tasks police are currently charged with and give them over to other agencies, often human service agencies, and shrink the duties of the police. And I think that is a question we have to be ready to answer in order to decide the best way to move forward.
And that's a huge question. I mean, I've talked to police departments and advocates who say we need police officers to have better training to deal with people having mental health crises. I think a lot of people are behind that. But other people are saying we need to unbundle it so that somebody other than a police officer is dealing with mental health issues. That's a really fundamental decision. Do we have case studies? Do we have evidence of people who have tried that unbundling approach in the United States or elsewhere?
There are limited and isolated examples of taking particular police functions and turning them over, particularly to mental health agencies or providers. You'll see in the executive order, there's an attempt to sort of strike a middle ground by promoting grants for cooperative response teams that would involve social workers and police officers or mental health workers and police officers. One of the challenges, of course, is that often police don't know what the problem is until they arrive on the scene, given the way that we currently allocate police resources. Civilians pick up the phone, dial 911, and summon the armed power of the state, as a former policing friend used to put it. And I think that that is, again, one of the questions we should ask ourselves is whether that is how we think police power ought to be allocated.
Now, we see some of the efforts really targeting specific things, including the idea of limiting chokeholds. Training standards proposed by President Trump would ban chokeholds, quote, except if an officer's life is at risk. Given the danger we've seen of chokeholds, not just in the George Floyd situation, but Eric Garner and others, is it worth that kind of tight focus on this one police tactic?
Well, certainly the use of force more broadly needs to be reexamined. It is already a subject of police training. Many agencies have reformed their policies over the past decade quite considerably, and most departments today either severely limit or ban chokeholds. It is a piece of what we need to pay attention to. Too many people have died as a result of the abuse of that restraint. But obviously, the questions and the problems we have are much larger than just that one issue.
Another issue protesters are raising is concerns about systemic racism in police departments. Given the difficulties of solving systemic racism in society at large, are there things that you think could be effective in the police context?
There are always ways that all of us, whether you're talking about university professors or media personalities like yourself or the police, could be improving our understanding of racism and the ways in which we may intentionally or unintentionally be contributing to it. There's been a lot of work done in how we can do that as a broader community and for police as well. But again, these changes, there's not one single magic fix. It's going to take a rethinking of what we are asking police to do and then how we want to prepare them to do that task in a way that's fair to everyone in our community.
I think it's easy as a policymaker to want that one quick fix or four or five things. Do you think we have, given, you know, the, as you said, dispersed nature of police control in the United States, do we have the attention span to try to come up with a thoughtful, you know, fundamental, broad-ranging fix here?
I mean, the attention span of the American people is a challenge to reform at every level of government and in private life as well, I think. But yes, I think that this is an issue that has been studied by people inside of the police community and outside of it quite extensively. There are multiple federal reports making recommendations on what 21st century policing ought to look like that have been sort of given the endorsement of leading police agencies themselves, as well as community leaders. And then there is a wide body of literature examining at the very specific level how to train police, how to develop meaningful policies, how to create accountability mechanisms. But many of those things will require change, and that is difficult, and it's especially difficult when you're talking about 18,000 different agencies, most of which involve 10 or fewer officers. And many of our policing agencies could use the support of government agencies at the state and the federal level in order to have the resources to be able to contemplate what change looks like for their communities.
Cecilia, thanks so much for joining us again.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's Cecilia Klingel, expert on criminal justice policy at the UW Law School. She was with us today to talk about the Trump administration's record on policing and an executive order the president signed yesterday that incentivizes changes to police use of force. Coming up, the NBA is ready to resume play. Major League Baseball still up in the air. We'll find out when we could see the Bucks and Brewers back in action. That's up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A few days ago, Major League Baseball's commissioner guaranteed there'd be a season amid the coronavirus pandemic. Then he said he couldn't promise that. We'll talk about where things stand today and check out pro basketball, too. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a look into how Wisconsin became the Badger State.
We recently received a listener question in the Wisconsin mailbag. Michael from Dane County asked, why is the Badger Wisconsin's state animal? WPR's John K. Wilson went digging to find out more.
Wisconsin is the Badger State. It's on the flag, it's the mascot of the state's biggest university, and back in 1957, lawmakers put the badger into state law as Wisconsin's official animal. But why? Badgers live in plenty of states, and they're pretty rare here. It's not like you see them running around willy-nilly like squirrels. To get some answers, I figured why not start by going straight to the source. Bucky, pretty common name for badgers, I guess, is the resident education badger at Henry Vilas Zoo in Madison. He goes on field trips and teaches kids about nature, so maybe he'd have something to tell me. On a recent morning, I talked with him in his enclosure while he was eating a hard-boiled egg. Hi, Bucky. John K. Wilson with WPR. Can I ask you a few questions? Do you know why the badger is Wisconsin's state animal? Any idea why you're on the state flag? I've seen this type before. Cute, but not a talker. Clearly, I needed someone with some more specialized knowledge.
My name is Jim Leary, and I'm a retired faculty at UW-Madison in Folklore and Scandinavian Studies.
Leary studies the history and culture of Midwestern people. He said the whole Wisconsin badger thing comes down to
lead mining in the late 1820s and into the 1830s and beyond in the southwest part of the state.
Yeah, lead mining.
In lead mining, there were little holes that people started to dig in and sometimes abandon, and they were called, sometimes called badger holes. But the prevailing story is that the early settlers actually lived in these holes, and that's where the name came from.
Turns out, though, that probably never happened. Leary says historians can't find any reliable evidence that miners actually lived in their badger holes. But either way, the name stuck. So, to boil it down, the badger is Wisconsin's state animal because 200 years ago, people here went digging for lead. And actual badgers also dig holes?
He is a great digger. He's got those really long front claws that are fantastic at digging burrows really quickly.
Back at the zoo, curator Jess Thompson had plenty of other good facts about real badgers like Bucky and his cousins in the wild.
There are a couple different types of badgers. There are badgers that live in Europe, European badgers. There's obviously the honey badger that many people know about in Africa. And there are some badgers that live in Asia. And most of those species are much more social. But our North American badgers are really solitary.
Thompson says badgers are ferocious hunters.
They also have jaws that are really hard to dislocate because of the way that they're attached in their skull. So because of that, they're able to attach really firmly onto their prey.
But aside from hunting prowess and a shared history of digging, is there something about badgers that makes them a good symbol for Wisconsin?
Definitely. Yeah, these guys are so resourceful, and they're known for being tough and being able to make it through a lot of different circumstances. So a lot of great qualities.
John K. Wilson is a digital editor at WPR and is the co-host of the WPR Politics Podcast. And this story came to us from a listener question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, a little more than 3 months ago, the Milwaukee Brewers had signed slugger Christian Yelich to a new long-term contract. Spring training had begun. The start of the regular season was less than a month away. And the Milwaukee Bucks were in the driver's seat for their first NBA championship in nearly 50 years. It's a great time to be a sports fan in Wisconsin. Then COVID-19 put everything on hold. Fast forward to June, it looked like there was hope for a baseball season. Well, then maybe not. And for basketball, there's a plan in place, but some question marks are still out there. Tom Goldman is NPR sports correspondent. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob. How you doing?
Well, good. Now, this baseball story just today, it's been bouncing around like a knuckleball coming at you. What is the latest there?
Yeah, that's a good one, and very hard to hit like a knuckleball.
Yeah.
We had a flurry of tweets today by baseball insiders. Just when we thought, you know, things were completely bleak and dead, we had a flurry of tweets saying that the two sides, the players and owners, were closing in on an agreement, and then the details started to leak out a little bit about what the agreement might be, and then Major League Baseball, the players' union, came out saying very succinctly, reports of an agreement are false, and that deflated everyone's balloon. But then Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred put an end to everything and gave us all a little hope. He said that he, in fact, did have a meeting with union head Tony Clark in Phoenix over the last couple of days, and they left, and I'm going to quote from his statement. He said, "We left that meeting with a jointly developed framework that we agreed could form the basis of an agreement and subject to conversations with our respective constituents." I won't read any further because it puts you to sleep, but basically there's hope when just two nights ago it all seemed lost.
What have players in the league been bickering over here?
Money.
What?
Which is money. Can you believe that? And obviously a really bad look, you know, with all that's going on in the world, with the pandemic, with social unrest, with huge unemployment, and players and even the baseball commissioner acknowledged that this was just a disastrous thing to do. But they've been going back and forth over money because they know, they all know, they all agree they have to play a shortened season. The question then becomes, how much do we play? How much do we pay players in that shortened season? The players have wanted more games. That means more money. Owners have wanted fewer games. And so that's where we're at. The details that have leaked out from today say that the latest owner's proposal is for 60 games starting mid-July, around July 19th or 20th. And then we'll see if the players fire off a counterproposal.
Do we know anything about fans versus empty stands?
We know that it will begin without fans in the stands. All those Brewers fans will have to be watching on TV. But the hope is that people will tune in because they love baseball enough. And what they really want to do is get to the postseason because that's where big TV money comes in. And at the beginning, at least, no fans in the stands, just like they've been doing in Korea. If you've watched any of the Korean baseball organization games on ESPN, it's a very strange look, but you know what? People will take their baseball however they can get it.
Now let's turn to basketball. Plans are much further along there, it sounds like.
Yeah, they are. They are. Right now, the latest news is that reporters have gotten a hold of the 100-plus page health and safety protocol plan for when 22 teams show up next month in July in Orlando at the Disney World Resort and play in a kind of a bubble. They'll play their 8 regular season games. They'll pick up where they left off after when the season paused in March. They'll play 8 regular season games and then go into a playoff system that will be similar to what they always play. And the plan is to the last possible day for an NBA Finals game, when the Bucks are crowned, would be right around October 12th or 13th.
You're putting a lock on that one. Whatever, however they arrange this, the Bucks are going to take it.
Well, unless they lose to the Portland Trailblazers, I am based in Portland, so a little biased. But it's a much tougher ask to get Portland into the playoffs than where Milwaukee sits right now, that's for sure.
And Tom, in our last minute, with any leagues, men's, women's, big sports, smaller, are there faster efforts to get fans back in stadiums or courses or fields or whatever?
You know, good question. Rob, right at this point, everyone is operating under the assumption, from golf to NASCAR to women's pro soccer to hockey to basketball and perhaps to baseball, everyone's operating under the assumption that fans will not be in the stands. At this point, it's too risky. We're seeing upticks already, as you, I'm sure you know, in a number of states, and several of them host Major League Baseball. So, you know, the people haggling over money are also keeping a very close watch on that, because after all the money squabbles, that ultimately could derail a season too if coronavirus proves too untenable.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, it's been a pleasure.
Tom Goldman is NPR sports correspondent. We talked to him about Major League Baseball's ongoing labor dispute and the NBA's plans to resume play in Disney World next month. Coming up, the COVID-19 pandemic and nationwide protests for racial justice are just two of the major tests the country has faced so far this year. We'll talk to a guest who says our institutions are failing the test when they're needed most. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, Keely Boltina and her guests look at the latest news on immigration during the COVID-19 pandemic and a big decision expected soon from the U.S. Supreme Court on the president's effort to end DACA protections. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, 2020 has put America to the test. Between the COVID-19 pandemic and the nationwide protests following the killing of George Floyd in police custody, people are calling on the government and civic institutions to provide health, safety, and equal justice. Our next guest says those institutions have grown less able and willing to meet those challenges and are failing on multiple fronts. He says without serious changes, the consequences for our society could be real and long-lasting. George Packer is an author, playwright, and staff writer for The Atlantic. His latest book, Our Man, was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. His recent piece for The Atlantic is titled Shouting into the Institutional Void. George, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure, Rob.
Well, you've been doing a lot of writing and thinking about the state of our social and civil institutions. First of all, can you talk about what you're referring to when we're throwing that phrase out there, the civil institutions of the United States?
Yeah, what I mean are the key institutions that people rely on to realize their aspirations in a democracy. So obviously government at all levels, including law enforcement, businesses and banks, which don't just have a mission to pay shareholders high dividends, but also to employ people and even to serve communities. Media organizations, which people rely on for reliable information, schools, all of those institutions that maybe functioned better in supporting what you could call a middle-class democracy, I would say 50 years ago, than they do now. And part of what I think we're seeing this year is the kind of the collapse of them in the face of unprecedented crises coming all at once in a 3-month period.
And you write that these crises didn't necessarily cause this collapse, but revealed the already existing weaknesses. Why is that?
I think for years we have had an unequal and what I call a heartless economy, which has grown more and more extremes between winners and losers over the last two decades. We've had a bureaucracy that has been less and less able to respond to and solve problems at the level of government. We have a political class whose corruption is normal and legal, and which is so polarized that it can't even begin to debate, let alone solve our most fundamental problems. And we have a public that is divided, distracted, and unable to come together to come to some consensus that could lead to lasting change. So this isn't to blame one side or the other necessarily, although I think there is some blame to go around, but it's to say all of these ills that were lying beneath the surface and that have been with us for a long time, like an unhealthy organism, suddenly turned out to be life-threatening when we came under the pressure of a pandemic, a recession, and nationwide protests.
When it comes to COVID-19, you wrote that the United States is, at least the headline said, a failed state, comparing very unfavorably with most of the countries in the world on our response. Spell that out for us.
Well, if you look at the numbers, we have been leading the world in COVID cases and COVID deaths, really from the beginning of the pandemic, far beyond our percentage of the global population. Roughly a quarter to a third of all worldwide cases and deaths have been American. Other countries have had a very hard time and have responded badly as well, including the UK and France. But ours has been particularly appalling mainly because of the total failure at the national level. There has been no leadership. There's been no plan. There's been no guidance. Instead, there's been chaos, wishful thinking, distraction, and in some ways doing exactly the wrong thing at crucial moments. So I think this is largely a self-inflicted status that we have as the world's COVID leader.
Talking to George Packer from The Atlantic, a writer and author, he says that our civic institutions in the United States have been weakening over the years and are failing now when presented with challenges like COVID-19, like the protests and the aftermath of the death of George Floyd. George, you contrast our response to George Floyd's death and the government response with what happened after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. You write that we didn't necessarily get things right there, but there was at least the possibility. There were the institutions with the strength to try to solve things. Spell out that contrast for us.
Right. In 1968, which was the fourth year of a series of springs and summers of unrest and violence, the whole country exploded. Cities across the country exploded in anger and in flames with the killing of Martin Luther King. A lot was going on at once. Lyndon Johnson, the previous summer, had created a commission, the Kerner Commission, to study the causes and prevention of urban unrest. And that commission kind of had people from what you could call the establishment. It was not, no one was radical on that commission, but it was the establishment from different sectors of society. And they came up with a report that was absolutely radical, and that diagnosed two Americas, one black, one white, separate and unequal, and that proposed all kinds of sweeping policy changes in housing, employment, education, and policing. It was overwhelmed by the King assassination and the riots that followed and all the events of that tumultuous year, the Kennedy assassination, the Vietnam War, the convention riots, et cetera. So it never really got any purchase. In a way, it was too late. But there was a president and there was a commission and there was an establishment and a report that all were like the tools of self-correction that were still in place and that could have made a difference, maybe if they had reacted sooner. Today, it's impossible to imagine any of that. I can't think of that commission and who would be on it and what authority they would have and who would they would be speaking for and to. I certainly can't imagine the president creating it and trying to get out ahead of this most fundamental national tragedy. And I can't imagine a Congress that could pass a law like in April of 68, the Congress passed the Fair Housing Act, the last great civil rights legislation of the 60s, right after the killing of Dr. King. That Congress wouldn't do that today. We will see if they can pass police reform. But given the record of Congress over the last decade or so, they don't solve problems anymore. They don't even debate problems. So those are the kinds of things I'm talking about and saying. Back then, we failed in our institutional efforts, but today we don't even have the tools to try.
It's a huge question, but where did we go wrong?
That is a big one. And there's no single cause. You know, I think the core problem in our country, to be to be a bit inflated in my language, is a lack of any social solidarity, a lack of a feeling of being in it together, having a national identity, a national narrative that Americans can agree on. And instead, we have many groups and many individuals each pulling in their own way and hating the others and despising the others on Twitter. Why has that happened? I mean, I think a big part of it has been globalization, which has created winners and losers in our economy and in our culture over the past couple of decades. I think a big part of it is an anti-government conservative ideology that has really driven our politics ever since Ronald Reagan was president, and that has made government less and less capable of doing the few things well that it used to do well. And perhaps there's also the fact that we are more and more a multiracial country, really beginning again back in the 60s with the Immigration Act, which Johnson signed in 65, that opened the doors again to immigration, and a multiracial country in which one population, white America, and particular group of white Americans feel more and more left out, besieged, overwhelmed, and are fighting to hold on to power in undemocratic ways. So all of, I don't know, that's a lot, it's a mouthful, but that's my best shot at kind of looking at the vectors, the big trends that are pushing us apart and have created the kind of institutional collapse that we're talking about.
You also point toward the Great Recession of 2008 and the solutions, the effective solutions that helped big institutions like banks and didn't necessarily so much help ordinary Americans as kind of one of the pivotal turning points. Can you talk about that?
I think so. I think that the financial crisis and the consequences, which was that banks and bankers came out okay, even though they were really considered and were the main perpetrators. They came out okay. No big banker went to jail. The banks were made whole again. Whereas ordinary Americans, middle-class, working-class Americans, lost their retirements, their jobs, their houses, and many of them never got back to where they had been. And I think that was a landmark failure that told Americans the system is rigged, government and business are somehow conniving together against the rest of us. It really fueled populism on both the right and the left. You could see Trump and Sanders both coming out of the failures of the Great Recession and the failure of government. Even the Obama administration, which I think had many positive ideas, but its failure to convince people that it was on the side of ordinary folks against the elites. And so we, ever since then, cynicism toward big institutions and elites has been growing. And now it's, I think statistics show it's at an all-time high.
We're talking to George Packer right now from The Atlantic about how the country's civil institutions are handling the tests of 2020 so far. He says, not very well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? How well do you think America is working in the face of the COVID-19 pandemic, in the face of protests after a police killing in Minneapolis? Do you worry that our lawmaking, justice system, media, other institutions aren't meeting the needs of society? What, if anything, needs to change? Have optimism that things can be fixed and work better? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with George Packer from The Atlantic about how the country has responded to the coronavirus, protests for racial justice, and more. His latest piece is called Shouting into the Institutional Void. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think the country's government and society are working or not working right now? Do you worry about the government's ability to solve problems and respond to social change? Are we so divided that we can't even agree on what a problem is, much less a solution? How do we fix that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. George, if you're right, we've got this decline in the function of so many institutions. What do you think we could do to start to fix that?
Well, I was thinking, Rob, during the break that these protests, and, you know, these are not the first protests in the last few years. There was the Tea Party, there was Occupy, there was the Me Too movement and the Women's March, and now the George Floyd protests. All these protests are a sign that the public doesn't feel that government is functioning and hearing and solving. So they're, even though they're a sign of great civic energy, they're also a sign of civic failure. And the solution is not a simple matter. And I don't have a simple answer to that. I think the results of the November election are going to be a crucial, necessary, but not sufficient answer. I think 4 more years of a president who inflames all these problems rather than trying to heal will mean a permanent condition that we will have a very hard time ever recovering from completely, because things, you know, that seem like they're temporary can be lasting conditions once they become deeply entrenched. So I think the election is crucial. Voting is crucial. The right to vote, which you know about in Wisconsin, which is a crucial issue in Wisconsin, is going to be the ball game in the next few months.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm sure I probably have a contrary opinion here, but I think the country is in a really bad place where I don't know if we're ever going to get out of. And I pin the blame on our media. Our media in this country only tells one side of a story and gives a platform for hate, whether it's the Al Sharptons of the world or those types of people, race hustlers and such. They create a narrative and they gin up hate. And I just don't see that changing because they won't admit it.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Steve, coming from a different perspective there, saying the media is ginning up the problems in some ways, George.
I mean, the media thrives on conflict. So the left criticizes the media when they report every tweet that Trump writes because it gins up conflict, and the right criticizes the media when they give a platform to what Steve calls race hustlers. In a way, it's built into the business model to thrive on conflict and not to report on the planes that landed safely. But think about the media today and how fragile it is. We no longer have a media that shapes a narrative. We have thousands of media. We have Twitter, which in many ways is more important, more influential than CBS, the New York Times, and National Public Radio. The gatekeepers are gone, and instead we have, you know, a kind of pandemonium of voices for better and for worse. And we also have a financial crisis in the media that's been going on throughout my career, really, where every year we're looking at the possibility of big cuts in budget. The Atlantic just had to lay off nearly 20% of its staff because of the COVID recession. So it's not as though the media is this sinister organized force that is all powerful in our society. In many ways, it has lost a lot of its power since the 60s when Walter Cronkite could go on the CBS Evening News and tell Americans that the war in Vietnam was a stalemate, and they believed him. There's no one like that any longer.
do you see that fragmented landscape, partly in the media, partly in social media, partly in our politics and our leaders, that fragmentation as being part of what's driving this decline in institutional effectiveness?
I do. Steve is right. I think the media has lost some conviction in itself as an impartial sort of as an aspiration toward objectivity. I think that has really faded. And there are things happening I don't like in the mainstream media, where I do think reporting is becoming more a form of activism than it ever was when I was, you know, just coming up in the media. I think that's becoming a more normal thing. And it worries me, because we have to have a media that the public can at least have some trust in, and that can have some kind of create some kind of majority agreement about at least what the facts are. We don't have that in this country. And as a result, the media seems to be moving back toward that 19th century model of partisan papers and now partisan websites, where each one has its own affiliation with a point of view, rather than what began in the late 19th, early 20th century, which was the idea of objective news. I think Steve's right that we're moving in that direction, and it worries me a lot.
Talking to George Packer, staff writer for The Atlantic. His latest piece is titled Shouting into the Institutional Void. He's worried that our institutions in the United States, government, business, media, keep going, isn't up to challenges like COVID-19, like major protests over issues of race. George, you contrast the idea of protesting in hopes that, you know, effective institutions can help solve problems versus protesting into a vacuum where there isn't that solution. Compare and contrast for us.
Well, I think that's the big question about the George Floyd protests. Will they sustain enough pressure and enough concentrated pressure to effect change, to produce legislation, reform of police departments, reform of city hall, and of the whole culture of policing? Because it's obviously not just a matter of body cameras. It's about the whole mindset in which police go about their work. This isn't an area I'm an expert on, but it's clear that we have a deep problem of distrust between police and a lot of Americans. If the protests produce reforms, then I think we'll see the beginning of a healthier term, where there actually is the ability to respond and channel and answer what the public is demanding. If not, you know, and it could go several ways, it may be that the protests themselves will sort of turn inward, and I see signs of that already, and focus more and more on speech and symbols and personal relations, rather than on the hard issues of what's happening in city streets and in police departments. And if that happens, and it sometimes does when we begin to open up big, big, deep old wounds, then we might end up just cannibalizing ourselves, which has happened in the past, and not affecting real change that can be felt in people's lives.
George, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to George Packer, staff writer at The Atlantic. His latest piece is titled Shouting into the Institutional Void. He's with us today to talk about how he sees our civil institutions failing to meet the needs of Americans and what it means for the future. Check out a related conversation to his point about telling the story of who we are as Americans. Yesterday we talked to Colin Woodard, author of the new book Union, about how that issue has played out since the dawn of American history. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, if you ever see ads in your life, you know that many companies have changed their messages during the pandemic. We'll look at the new marketing strategies and whether they work. Restaurants and restaurant workers took some of the biggest economic hits from the COVID-19 outbreak. They're still not back to normal. We'll look at the prospects for restaurants in Wisconsin and around the country. And recreational vehicles, or RVs, are seeing new popularity as a way to travel while keeping up social distancing. We'll look at the RV in the age of COVID-19. That more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. It's the morning show with Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, food writer and cookbook author Mark Bittman brings the bread. Join the show for great advice on baking at home with All Breads Considered. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk to a Landlords Association leader and an Eviction Defense Project leader about what's been happening since a statewide ban on evictions went away at the end of May. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.